Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, in this episode, it's my pleasure to talk to Kieran Finnan. They say nepotism works well so long as it's kept in the family. But the one big question for many family businesses is that transfer from the first generation who started the business to the next generation. Finnline Furniture was originally set up by husband and wife team Kieran and Bridget Finnan in 1979. Recognising the lack of high-quality Irish handcrafted sofas and chairs, their vision to fill the gap was the basis on which the business was created and operates today. Over the next decade, Finnline continued to expand and began exporting into the UK and the Middle East markets. In 2009, eldest son Kieran joined the business. As a wholesale-only business, they began to explore new opportunities when the economic downturn of the late 2000s took hold. Rethinking the business model led them down new avenues, and in 2012, the first showroom in the factory in Emo, County Leash was opened. More retail operations have followed. In 2013, younger brother Killian joined the family business. Killian, working alongside brother Kieran, brought a new dimension to the business. Kieran, you're very welcome to the podcast, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Aidan. Great to be here.
Good. Right, where to begin? I suppose let's talk about the business in general, the furniture business in general. And I think most people now will be very well aware of the IKEA phenomenon that seems to have taken hold. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't a serious demand for high quality handmade furniture everywhere else, is it?
No, I think IKEA certainly serves a purpose, Aidan. I've been there myself and I've bought some of their products over the years and it serves a very good purpose. But certainly there is a want in the market for people to buy, I suppose. Maybe our market particularly is probably an individual who's maybe done the IKEA thing initially for maybe their first home or their first rental apartment or whatever that may be. And they've decided they want something that's going to maybe look a little bit better. That's built maybe and manufactured to a higher standard than something you might buy in IKEA, and something that they maybe want to have for a long, long period of time and possibly even hand down to their children in years to come, and also have the option around bespokeability where the furniture itself can be made to any size, to any, in any fabric, to any comfort level, etc.
And then what's the competition for Finnline? And I suppose, we need to think about the fact that there's the wholesale side and then the retail side. So if we focus first on the wholesale and the manufacturing side, what's the competition there?
Well, simply anybody who's selling furniture really is our competition, I guess you could say. But in our, I guess, more middle to high-end sector, it would be your high-end retailers, your DFSs, Harvey Norman, albeit we would see our product as maybe being superior to a lot of the competition out there. There's a lot of UK manufacturers also in our sort of price point that would be exporting into Ireland from the UK that we'd be in competition with as well. But I guess we're in a unique sort of a position in that we're kind of vertically integrated. So as well as manufacturing, we're also retailing. So there aren't many in our sector who can actually, I suppose, cover the whole range from manufacture and design right through to retail. So we can actually cater for a client who comes to us and has seen a beautiful sofa somewhere in their travels or at a trade show or at an exhibition, etc. And invariably we have our in-house designers who can make something that will be akin or close to. We have to be very cognizant obviously of copyright and different things like that, that we can't be copying people. But we can come up with our own, spin on that particular model and create something. And even things like now in the marketplace, corner groups and L-shaped sofas are very, very popular now, where they weren't, say, 10 years ago. But we can make corner groups to literally to within an inch of a customer's requirement. And people want that nowadays. You know, people are, they can jump online, they can do a huge amount of research, and they want, if they're going to spend, our average sort of sale will be somewhere between maybe 3,000 and 4,000 euros. So obviously, if you're spending that kind of money, you want something that's very specific to you and bespoke to you, and something you can tell your friends and your family that was made especially for you.
And I suppose that, you know, everybody, as you said, loves going to hotels and seeing these beautiful things, but then when they get home, they fail to realise that their sitting room is not the size of the hotel sitting room. So you're able to make it to the size that, that actually, you know, it does doesn't look like this big monster stuck in the room, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
And in terms of the export side of the business, right? You know, I said you were in the UK, Middle East, and this. How did that journey start in terms of going into the UK? But even I find more interesting is the Middle East angle.
Yeah, the UK thing probably came about. We would have done some trade shows back. This was prior to my time ever in the business. My father, Kieran, and my mother, Bridget, would have taken part in some trade shows in the UK. And we would have had a very good reputation at the time in Ireland. And some UK retailers actually came to us looking for us to export to the UK. So that kind of came, I suppose it just came about kind of in an ad hoc manner as much as anything. And the furniture trade in the UK is quite small actually, and everybody talks to everybody else. So when something works well, or you bring something to the market that's good quality, the word gets out there fairly quickly. So we would have had exhibitions ourselves down at our factory sort of twice a year, where we bring over maybe a dozen retailers from the UK who would all know each other very well and would have purchased products from us. And then over the maybe about 6 or 7 years ago, we had a very good agent in the UK who introduced us to a diplomatic service provider. So essentially, this company is an FCO, Foreign and Commonwealth Office approved supplier to the UK government. So through them, we've exported to about 75 countries. Mm-hmm. So mostly to ambassador level residences throughout the world. It has to go through a bonded warehouse in the UK. It has to be made to UK and Irish standards. And for fire treatment, etc. And also, because it goes through bonded warehouse, there's no bombs or any potential issues within the furniture that could be seen as a security risk for ambassadors, etc. And then in the Middle East, in Dubai, we've done some work out there, mostly hotel work, again, through a UK contact that we would have dealt with back in the day who would have moved to Dubai. Mm. So through them, we've done a lot of private residences and majlises as well. They obviously entertain a lot at home in the culture out that part of the world, and they spend a lot of money on doing up their houses because they entertain so often. So you could have some houses out there that might have 20, 25, 30 sofas just within one room. So obviously that's a very nice order to get, all and invariably in very high standard, high quality fabrics. And then in 2014, we are the first Irish company to exhibit at the Shanghai International Furniture Fair. So that was an experience. And obviously exporting to China comes with its own challenges as well, with physically getting product out there, etc. But we've had a pretty good experience out there. And thankfully, at the time, we had great assistance from Enterprise Ireland. Have to give them a shout out. They've been excellent all in the journey, both in Dubai and the Middle East and in China, in opening up new doors for ourselves.
And the local tastes in terms of, you know, when you go to China, Dubai, is it a very oriental style that they're looking for? Or actually, are they looking for much more of the traditional Irish English type furniture, because there is a kind of a perceived cachet with that old world?
No, the tastes are very different. So they want very OTT. They want all the bells and whistles. They want all your fancy piping, your cords, your ruching. It's got to look very, very fancy, very, very high end. And where here, maybe we would have a predominance of plain fabrics on our sofas and chairs, out there they'd be going for big medallions, big prints, big florals.
Everything is big.
Yeah, something you might see in your house, eh? I'd imagine.
No, definitely not.
But certainly very different to local tastes in Ireland and the UK.
The other big thing, I suppose, and it's sweeping across a lot of industries now, is this whole move to sustainability. And, you know, there would have been, as you go through clothing, you went and furniture, there was a period where it was all about disposability. You buy it, you use it, you get rid of it, right? And we've seen a big kind of backlash to that. Now, you know, when you look at the type of products that you guys are doing, they have longevity. They're well made, they have longevity. So, you know, they lend themselves naturally to the reuse, recycle, upcycle, sustainable thing. You know, is that a big driver now within the business?
It is a freight train, I would say, in within the interior sector. The whole issue of sustainability, etc. There's absolutely no doubt about that. We're in a lucky position that we're actually manufacturing in Ireland. So for people buying in Ireland, obviously our carbon footprint is relatively low. But we, at the moment, offer a 20-year frame and construction guarantee on all the furniture that we make. And we're actually very seriously considering extending that to giving a lifetime warranty on our furniture. So what that means, in simple terms, is that our furniture will never have to go to landfill, which is very important, obviously, to us and to the environment, needless to say. So we are working around having a fully circular product. So that if you, for instance, buy a sofa from us today, in 10, 15, 20 years, assuming we're all around and we're all healthy and we're all in good fettle, our intention would be that maybe we would buy back that sofa from you, upcycle that sofa, so maybe recover it in a new fabric, etc., give it new maybe foams, whatever needs to be done, and then actually sell that on. And we're considering actually doing that with furniture that maybe people have purchased within the last 10 years as well.
Okay.
So if you buy a sofa off us, you know you can give it to your sons or daughters or friends or whatever it is, or put it into a rental property, and it'll never ever have to go to landfill. All our frames are FSC approved. They're Killindried Beech frames. We now have a couple of ranges of recycled polyester fabrics. So they are recycled from bottles. So there's a lot we can do as a local Irish company in the sustainability. And I think a lot of people are paying kind of lip service to sustainability, increasingly so in our industry particularly. And, you know, we're working with Enterprise Ireland actually as well on a circularity project as well to make sure everything is approved and we have certification, etc. So we're not just paying lip service to it. So we are actually living it and doing it properly.
I think that will be the next step in it. Like I just say, it's way too easy for people to talk the talk without actually walking the walk. And if it's going to be a credible movement, there needs to be that, not quite certification, but there needs to be a very clear and transparent level of what looks good on for sustainability and people carrying that out.
Yeah, and people are getting wiser, and there's so much education and so much chatter around this particular area that I think people are beginning to ask the questions, which is a great thing, because it's too easy for people and businesses particularly to say that they're, and it really, for a lot of people, I think it's just a tick the box exercise. So we want to move beyond that. And fairness, Enterprise Ireland, again, are working towards, you know, ensuring that companies aren't just paying lip service and just ticking a box, that they are actually living and doing the correct things to ensure that it is a sustainable product.
Switching tacks a little bit, I mentioned about the whole idea of family businesses and you know, one of the key things, I suppose, for most people when they think about the job is they work in their job, they go home, and the two things are very, very separate. You know, working as a family, in a family business, where does the business end and the personal start, or does it ever, you know?
Well, we're the classic, I guess, family business in that, like I would have been age one when my mum and dad, Kieran and Bridget, would have started the business in 1979. And, you know, growing up, it was literally all that was discussed around the dinner table, morning, noon and night. I mean, my father worked all hours, you know, he would have slept in the factory when it was first built, and my mother would have worked all hours. She did the books. She used to work in AIB and would have kept a tight rein on my owl lad when he was mad.
Had
to
all
spend
these great
money,
plans.
All these big plans, etc. But they were a brilliant team. And I mean, nowadays, to set up a big manufacturing facility like we have would be very, very difficult. The barriers to entry are massive, you know, even issues around health and safety and all that
and
kind
staff.
Of thing. Staffing obviously would be a massive issue. And physically, you know, the cost of kitting out a factory with equipment, etc., would be huge. So, but I mean, we would have grown up in that environment where it was literally just we lived and breathed the business of furniture and selling furniture and manufacturing, etc. And it was very interesting, but I guess maybe, you know, as a kid or whatever, it was it got a bit, it was a lot to take in, I guess, at the time, you know, for us as children or whatever. But it was a tough business, and mom and dad had four kids that they had to bring up. My father would have left school at 15, so it was a big risk for him to leave what was a fairly stable job, and actually, like, he really did proper jump in the deep end of the pool, you know, and it was a very entrepreneurial move at the time. And I guess it certainly wasn't boring growing up, I could certainly say.
And can I assume from that then that it was always almost a foregone conclusion that you were going to go into the business, and your brother Killian?
Probably not, actually. Okay. Aidan, to be honest, I would say, like,
did you fight hard?
Well, probably, maybe. It was sort of, it was certainly wasn't a natural progression straight from school or college into the business. I would have gone out after I finished college. I would have gone to the business masters out in Smurf Business School, and then I headed out to Australia and acted the maggot for a year or whatever, and then would have come back, and I worked with a sportswear business. I would have been involved in bringing it to Ireland at the time, and it did very, very well, and sort of was at a crossroads. And I guess myself and my brother would have grown up in the environment. We were the ones that were sort of doing the jobs in the factory. You know, you're sweeping the floors and loading lorries and going out in lorries for the day. So we didn't probably have a very glamorous sort of view of the business. A lot of it was unpaid labour as well at the time, unfortunately. But I guess we would have had a bit of a view of the business that it maybe wasn't a correct view necessarily. And I suppose I would have had a conversation with my mother and father back in about 2008 about coming back into the business. And I suppose we set out some not necessarily ground rules, but sort of an understanding that what my role would be, and it would be more sales based and would be more sort of I guess leadership based, etc., in the business. After having done a certain amount of years and proving myself as well, I was very conscious of that as well. And I mean, we're very lucky. We have an outstanding staff down in our factory in County Laois. We have four staff with us over 40 years. Okay. We've another dozen or so staff that are with us over 25 years. So like there was already a very good culture within the business that I was sort of walking into, which made it quite easy from that point of view, having such good people within the organisation.
And how is it the same kind of divvying up task between you and Killian, in that you have certain things you do, he does certain things, or is there much interaction and head-to-head combat, shall we say?
Yeah, no, we're very lucky. Killian's a bit younger than me, but I mean, the business is very much 50-50. I would be more, I suppose, at the sales end of the business, and Killian would be more at the operational end. He would be more factory based, and I suppose I'd be more maybe out in the road or client facing or travelling a little bit more to exhibitions and different things. But we work very well together, and I guess we overlap now and again, and now and again we do have, like any family business, we're not all going around hugging each other kumbaya all the time or anything like that.
It's like any business, never mind family or
otherwise.
Exactly,
absolutely. But I have to say we get on exceptionally well, and you know, when you work with your brother as well, you maybe lose a little bit of that sort of, you know, brotherly love where, you know, because you see each other every day and stuff like that. But we try and, where we can, get out for a round of golf or go to a rugby match together or whatever it is.
That isn't business related.
Exactly. Like on Sunday was my wee twins' communion, and Killian came down with his kids. And it's fabulous to just, you know, just have a day together where we're not talking business, which is, it's lovely to do that for a few hours.
Then the other part of the old intergenerational business is the new guard versus the old guard, right? And I suppose first question is, how did your dad decide that was the time that it was for him to take the step back? You know, I always wonder about people, what is it in their mind that suddenly go, actually, you know what, now is the time. It wasn't a year ago, it's not in 2 years' time. This is the time.
Our mother sadly passed away in 2013, so, and she was very, very involved in the business. So I think around that period of time, Dad probably, and he had worked very hard all his life. You know, he'd left school at 15 and had worked in a lot of different jobs, etc., before starting Finline. And I think he probably got to a stage where he wanted to take a little bit of a back seat following our mother's passing. So he stayed on, and I guess maybe the recession as well in 2010 through 2014-15, it was a tough period, very, very tough period in our sector particularly. So probably he was at a stage where he, you know, was lucky that he'd, you know, probably done okay out of the business and was ready to maybe take a bit of a back seat. So myself and my brother at the time would have sat down with him and come to an understanding that we were all fairly happy with at the time, I think. He would have still had quite a big input in the company. The culture of the company is still reflective of him and my mother in a huge way, in a massive way, you know. And
well, you can see that in terms of the tenure of the staff, you know, that you know, you don't find companies that people have been working 30 and 40 years for and not have that strong underlying culture that can kind of, unless, you know, the next generation come in and they are complete head the balls, right? That culture kind of is ingrained long before the second generation or ever.
Absolutely. Like, there's still huge respect within the organization. And even going out to trade shows and different things, like, my father would be very well respected. Everybody would always ask about him. He was a great man, as you might be interested in, for an old tip on a share. So he'd often go to trade shows in Belgium or Turkey or wherever, and some lads would have put a few quid into something. And they'd be like, your father lost me a right few quid back in the day. But he's a great, he's a very sociable individual, and he loves the odd pint or two at night and plays a bit of golf and stuff like that. So over the years he's built up a lot of friends in the industry, and we're benefiting from that still today.
Right. The other thing we move to now, and again, I talked in the intro about, you know, those sliding door moments, and probably if you look back in the history of the company, one of the big sliding door moments was that move into retail, right? So, you know, do you want to take me through that and what the thought process was at the time, and, you know, if you could do it, if you could change anything how you did it, would you do that, or are you kind of happy with how it's panned out?
Yes, the move from wholesale to retail was probably forced upon us. Okay. As much as it been, we like to say it was a brilliant strategic decision and aren't we brilliant or whatever, but in actual fact, we were probably faced in, say, 2010, 2011, with a situation where we'd gone probably from a staff of maybe 60 or 70 people down to sort of 25 or 30. We're on short time. A lot of our retail partners that we were wholesaling to in the UK and Ireland had started bringing in cheaper furniture from the Far East or China, etc. Essentially, they had to do it because the market was so deflated at the time. So we took at the time a very tricky decision to become retailers, because almost overnight we lost all our wholesale business because we were now essentially trading in competition to our what were formerly our partners. So it was a tricky decision at the time, but on reflection, it's been a good one. I mean, there would have been a huge manufacturing in the furniture sector business in, say, Monaghan and Meath, particularly Navan, you might know, back in the day. There would have been multitudes of factories making furniture, from hard furniture to soft furniture like ours, etc. Massive, 80-90% of those factories actually closed. Some were huge factories up in Monaghan, employing 200-300 people. And unfortunately, they all shut down at that time because of this influx of furniture from the Far East. So we were in a position where we could go retail. And we did that first initially at our factory in County Leash. We converted sort of an entire sector of the factory into maybe about 8,000 or 10,000 square feet of retail space. And then we moved up to Dublin to the Longmire Road and opened a showrooms up there. And subsequently, we've opened in Cork and Galway as well in recent years.
And you mentioned that conflict where, you know, you've gone into competition with people who were your previous customers. How do you manage that conflict today now, or is it not as big a problem today as it was when you started out?
It's fine. I mean, we're all in our own lane, I guess, in business. You know, we see people at trade shows or at different events and whatever, and, you know, it's all very respectful. I mean, I think those individuals would respect the fact that we probably wouldn't be open today and wouldn't be employing people and trading away if we didn't make the move at the time. So the relationship is generally quite good. No real issues there with anybody at all. I mean, it's a small enough sector and everybody seems to get on fairly well, but at the same time just does their own thing.
And I suppose the other thing too, when you think about businesses in general, you know, typically when with success comes this real risk of distraction, you know, that you go out and, you know, as you become more successful, you suddenly say, oh, well, do you know what we'd be brilliant at? Do you know what we'd be brilliant at, right? Now, there's probably a few of them that are completely harebrained ideas and you're lucky that somebody comes in and hits you over the head and says, cop on to yourself. But, you know, as you look at the next phase of growth, you know, so there's obviously the installed base, but is there another, pardon the pun, leg to the stool for Finland?
Yeah, we get a lot of fugazis, and I probably do as well, Aidan, where we think we'll be great at this and then it turns out not to be so great after all, or often something just falls in our lap and we haven't even, there's been no strategic sort of planning around it. It's all very sort of, it's, I guess, again, we're a small enough family business, so we're in a position where we're quite mobile and lean, and we can move with whatever we do. But like in recent years, we've got a little bit more into sort of the PRS fit out business side of things. So we have a fit out business that we're involved in as well. So we would have done a lot of with some of the funds, say out in Cherrywood, for instance, we would have fitted out about 800 apartments last year, not just with sofas, but with dining and bedding, lighting, etc. The whole lot. Yeah. So some things, I guess, to answer your question, some things work out pretty well. Other things, I mean, myself and my brother would, you know, now and again we sit down and we have brainstorming meetings, things like that, and often, you know, they're harebrained, absolutely off the wall sort of stuff. But sometimes you just hit on something that works pretty well. But for every one that goes well, there's plenty that don't, I can tell you.
And on that point then, you know, who do you seek advice from? Who do you seek counsel from? And who have you over the years?
Yeah, well, we get on very well with my dad, so we'd usually have a chat with dad before we do anything too major within the business, I suppose, just to see sort of his angle on it as well. And personally, I'm quite involved in Leash Chamber of Commerce, so there's a few people there who I'd respect a lot, who I'd lean on a little bit now and again for a little bit of advice. And I'd have a few friends in sort of that are, you know, in similar-ish positions to myself in family businesses, and so would my brother as well, who we'd have a chat with about different things. And my wife is involved, Kate is involved in the business as well, so to take the family thing a bit further, so she's actually a pharmacist, but now she's working in the business, and so in fairness, I'd lean on her a lot before making decisions on different things.
And when you look at the business overall, what percent of the success would you say is down to luck, and how much is down to hard work?
I would say, I don't know, maybe sort of half and half, something like that. Certainly hard work is something we're not afraid of, I don't think, in the business, and our employees we have within the business are incredible. And I mean, everybody who comes to work in our factory gives absolutely 10 out of 10 every single day that they're there. But a lot of luck, I think. We did get lucky by going retail at the time, and obviously margins are very good as well. When you go, albeit you're dealing with the end user, which comes with its own issues, needless to say. But we are, I suppose, it's a little bit of both. A little bit of both, Aidan.
Yeah. The other thing I suppose that's interesting about family business, particularly long established ones like yours, is, you know, there's an idea out there that when it comes to your workforce, if you want somebody to act like an owner, they need to be an owner, right? So, you know, how do you square, because you, like, it's funny, like, and maybe it's down to the culture that you have such a longevity of in terms of tenure of staff in there, that they don't necessarily, they almost feel like quasi owners because they have an emotional investment in it as opposed to necessarily a financial investment in it.
I think it comes from our managers within the business. So our production managers particularly are both with us 20-25 years, and they essentially set the standard in the factory. Mm-hmm. We also have a bonus system in our factory.
Okay.
So the more individuals produce, and it's a line system. So if I'm upholstering a piece of furniture, I'm working in a team of, say, four, for instance, and the more we make together, the more we ultimately make at the end of the week. So it works very well in that it motivates, it's self-motivating, it keeps people honest, and it means that everybody is sort of accountable for what they make in a given day. So we're very lucky. It doesn't need a lot of policing or need a lot of monitoring at all. We have daily reports and weekly reports that we go through in production meetings every week, and it's actually very consistent. We make between about 250 and 300 pieces of furniture a week. So we obviously have to feed the factory. That's tricky as well. At different times, we can have higher order levels versus other times. So at sort of quieter times, say during the summer, for instance, we have to try and get a little bit more orders from wherever it is, be it contract or be it from hotels or whatever the case may be. So that's I guess where we're at with that.
And you mentioned that you know, another interesting one, I suppose, given what we've come out of in terms of COVID, supply chain issues must have been serious problem, and the fact that the retail was closed for large parts of the period as
well. Yeah, it was tricky. We would have had across our sector, we would have had foam particularly went bananas in price. I think it went up 50-60% at one stage, so that was a massive shock to the system. Our frames went up, our beech, we use beech predominantly in our frames, that would have gone up 30-40%. I mean, we used to have stand-up rows with our frame suppliers, over 2% increases, and suddenly we're getting 30%.
Okay.
And it was sort of take it or leave it kind of thing, you know, with a lot of our suppliers. And our springs came from the UK, so obviously there was factors there around supply chain issues from the UK. So Brexit on top of COVID, and it was very, very tricky for a stage. And you have to be conscious, you don't want to necessarily lump all that onto your prices, because then you become uncompetitive and you leave yourselves open to be sort of perceived as a very expensive brand. So we obviously had to take a lot of it where possible. We had to absorb a lot of the increases ourselves and pass on, you know, a percentage obviously to the customer. We're lucky, everyone was in the same boat. So everyone within the industry was increasing prices through that stage. But we were lucky. We've very, very good suppliers, our foam supplier. We were probably one of only two clients that they didn't let down at any stage. There was no supply chain issues, albeit the prices had gone way up. So we've cultivated relationships, and I think we've looked after all our suppliers fairly well over the years, and I think we were paid back fairly well during COVID.
That's important, all right. Kind of a few left fielders for you now. What's the best book you've read, or the most enjoyable book you've read?
The best book I have read is probably Open by Andre Agassi.
Okay.
I love an L Sports book, and into tennis a little bit as well. And I love that book. I actually thought it was really good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll hopefully, as we get more and more of these under our belt, we'll have lots of younger people listening to us. What advice would you give to a young person now?
Enjoy life and experience as many things as you can. Get out there. I think people, where possible, travel as much as you can and experience as much of the world as you possibly can, because when you do settle down eventually, you certainly won't get the chance to do it.
Yeah, it's amazing how the wings get clipped when you have to grow up. All right. I suppose on the business, the final one on the business, and it might be a bit of a difficult question, but do you see it staying in family hands for the next generation?
Good question, and not one I've thought about too much. My kids are fairly young, and my brother's kids. Cheap employment. Yeah, those little hands can be handy, you know, for sewing and that kind of thing. But maybe in years to, I mean, I obviously you would love for it to pass to the next generation, and that would always be at the front of your mind. But like, I mean, we have to be you know, very respectful of the fact that we have 75 employees in the business, and like whatever strategy we take has to respect that fact. So hopefully in years to come, my kids or Killian's kids, or maybe even my two sisters might have kids or who might be interested in coming into the business. And I'd love if they did. and it would be great, but it has to make sense, obviously, at the time. And nepotism, you know, as you say,
it works well when it's kept in the family.
Exactly. Yeah, but hopefully, it's a few years off at this point, but who knows.
Now, I'm starting a tradition on this podcast whereby the last question that I ask you, I don't know what it is, and a previous person who has done it has written the question into this little book I have here. So I don't know what the question is going to be, but I'm going to ask you it now, and you know, God only knows where we're going to be, right? But, right, this is the question for you. It's an interesting one. If you had no fear, what is the one thing you would do and why? No fear of anything. What's the one thing you do?
Jesus. With no fear of anything. Well, I'd love to do a skydive, but I'm too afraid of that. But
that's what I'm saying. You have no fear, so you could, that could be it if you wanted to be.
Yeah, I'm not great with heights, so yeah, I'd love to do a skydive, but and maybe it's not a very interesting answer, Aidan. But that's all I can come up with at this minute.
Well, look, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Kieran Fanan, coming in. I think we had a great conversation there. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.